Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, who is among the candidates running for the Democratic nomination for the 2020 presidential race. Governor Hickenlooper talks about his focus on expanding access to healthcare for all Americans, especially those in rural parts of the country, addressing the opioid crisis and the nation's gun violence issue as well. Lori Robertson also checks in, managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Governor John Hickenlooper here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
I'm Margaret Flinter.
And we're speaking today with former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, a Democratic candidate for the 2020 presidential nomination. Prior to serving as governor, he was the mayor of Denver, Colorado, and trained as a geologist. He turned entrepreneur, launched a brew pub in Denver, which expanded nationally. He earned his undergraduate degree in English and his master's degree in geology at Wesleyan University. And while he was at Wesleyan University, he's one of the founding fathers of the Community Health Center, which produces Conversations on Healthcare. Governor Hickenlooper, we are so glad that you're here joining us. You're at a reunion at Wesleyan and you've made time for us. So welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, it's so great to be with you. And thank you for not just for having me on the show, but for all that you have done at Wesleyan, which is a place that's got, you know, world music and all these different things. But it really is about innovation.
That's right.
And, you know, it's entrepreneurial. And entrepreneurs are people that create innovation. And that's what you've done here. So it's, and I would argue maybe it's no accident that the Community Health Center and your reach in so many of these facets of healthcare happen so close to a really innovative school.
That's a very good point. Fertile ground here. And, you know, Governor, you've been traveling around the country and you've been talking to average citizens about your candidacy. And one of the topics that comes up, that you were raised by a single mom, your dad died when you were 8 years old. And I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners about your childhood experience and how they've formed your values and impact your campaign today.
Sure. And it's interesting, the roundtable that we had with some of the practitioners and clients at the Community Health Center, and people talked about adverse childhood experiences,
right.
And they can take many forms. And oftentimes, kids don't understand exactly how things are affecting them. Certainly, my father got sick when I was 4, intestinal cancer, back when they didn't really know how to deal with it. They just went in and kept cutting out more of it. Yeah. The only antibiotics that they had was penicillin, which after a couple of years he developed a tolerance for. So then he always had infections of one sort or another. It's just really a hard time for a kid, and I just turned 8 when he passed away. And it really took me a couple decades to kind of process through that. I never really connected that experience, or that there obviously a whole sequence of experiences there, to why I had so little confidence, why I, even though I was an extrovert, I couldn't go up and talk to other kids and say, hey, can I play basketball with you guys at the, you know, next door neighbor, or things like that. And certainly as we understand more about the psychology of adverse childhood experiences and how they have a long tail,
That's right.
Yeah. It is interesting to see places like what the Community Health Center is doing, where you have, you're merging together this notion that someone who is going to see a kid about maybe a dental visit or they've got a cold or whatever, and yet upon certain exhibition of certain behaviors, right there on that day, they can someone who's a behavioral specialist. And I can't wait to see the data that you guys collect over the years of getting that rapid intervention and just how big a difference. Clearly, my gut feeling is it'll make a huge difference.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm going to pivot a little bit, if I can, from that. And I always appreciate your sharing your personal story there. I think it rings true with people. Everybody experiences loss. But you made it on to Wesleyan, English major.
Barely.
I think I heard somebody once say you were there so long, they gave you tenure as a student. I always thought that was a great quote.
Some of the professors banded together, yes.
But you went from English to geology, right? You went west, as so many people have over the years, became a geologist, and as so many people find themselves at some point in life, were laid off, had to do something else, and you did something incredibly creative, started a brew pub back when there was not a brew pub on every corner of every major city in the United States. And I have always admired how you created a neighborhood and then revitalized a business community. And you took that national and learned a lot of lessons about small business in the process. And as you enter this incredible phase, how does that experience as a small businessman and then somebody helping other small business people kind of influence what your thoughts are in this political campaign? What do you bring to politics from that experience?
I guess in a funny way, we all are descendants of our previous experiences.
Yeah.
And certainly when my mother was widowed twice before she was 40, and she would tell us, you can't control what life throws at you, but you can control how you respond, whether it makes you stronger or weaker. And when I got laid off in Colorado, there were no other geology jobs. 10,000 geologists got laid off. No one was hiring.
Unbelievable.
And so I had to deal with that and my mother's lesson, right? That she never complained. You know, she sewed her own clothes. She'd wash tinfoil so she could reuse it. She was just very flinty. I'm not making a play on your word, Margaret, or your name. She was very flinty. And, you know, that model really served me well because it took a couple years to get that brew pub started. We were the 12th brew pub in North America, and people didn't know what it was.
Right.
And so many, so often with entrepreneurs, if there really is white space out there, people haven't seen this before.
That's right.
You have to sell something, but it's the innovation is something they've never seen before. So they, for many people, it's hard for them to believe or invest in something that they've never experienced. But those experiences of getting the other restaurant owners in lower downtown Denver to work together, collaborating and really building that neighborhood, and then going up to the city and becoming mayor, and then getting all the suburbs to work with the city. So we got all 34 mayors to support a transit initiative, right? What we called Fast Tracks. But, you know, 34 mayors, 21 Republicans all supported a major tax increase to build, you know, Fast Tracks is the, I think without question, the most ambitious transit initiative in modern US history. And we were united. So then when I ran for governor in 2010, I became the first Denver mayor in 120 years to get elected governor. That's how wicked the animosity had been for so long between the city and the suburbs and the city and the rest of the state. But on a state level, we did the same thing. We said we're going to lift everyone up and we weren't going to leave behind the rural areas.
Yeah.
By the end of 2020, Colorado will be the first state with high-speed broadband in every city and town. And Colorado's had, for the last 3 years, we've had the number one economy in the country, according to U.S. News and World Report. But we think for 2018, we will have the number one rural economy for the first time. And I think that almost means more to me that that we are all one. And we want to make sure we don't leave behind some parts of our population. Again, one of the great things about the community health center movement is you guys are pioneers in telemedicine, pioneers in making sure that we get good healthcare coverage in the rural parts of America.
Right.
And how do you do that at a cost-efficient basis?
Mm-hmm.
And your models, family nurse practitioners, telemedicine, they are ways of providing high quality excellence in terms of healthcare, the delivery of healthcare. But at the same time, finding ways to do it where in rural areas where you don't have the density of patients, where you can do it and still be cost effective.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about healthcare access because it seems that through the lens of being raised by a single mother, and I would say our experience is that single mothers have difficulty accessing healthcare, but also small businesses have to make decisions between investing capital and paying good wages and providing good benefits. And that's been a historic problem. But the third point you just talked about, rural communities, how have those shaped your thinking about what you'd like to see happen as you think about the country as a whole and look through that lens of single moms, small businesses, rural communities? What's your thought about what the healthcare system might look like and how people might access it?
I mean, that is the $64,000 question to a large extent as we begin this transition. And I think America is transitioning to a place where healthcare is a right and will be understood and accepted to be a right in this country. And where are those places where we have the greatest challenges? And single moms, obviously, so often they're working multiple jobs. The chaos with what they deal within their lives is so challenging. And certainly teenage mothers, who are single moms, which we see again and again. One of the big programs we pushed in Colorado, part of our healthcare plan has always been that women have authority. They get to control their own healthcare. They get to control their own bodies. And, you know, from this, remember there was a book when we were kids, Our Bodies, Ourselves.
Oh,
still
yeah.
in print.
Still there.
Right, but that's the foundation of that belief. We provided 15 to 25-year-old young women the access to total healthcare, but part of that included family planning, so they could decide when they wanted to have a family. And if you look at the statistics that have come out of this, again, we provided long-acting reversible contraceptions. Yep. We reduced teenage pregnancy and teenage abortion by 60%. Hmm. And what's so astounding about this is so often, before that intervention, a young teenage mother, 17 or 18, would have a second child as a right. single mother before they turned 20.
That's right.
And we really have interrupted that cycle. And we know all the statistics, what a single mom is faced with, especially yeah. as a teenager, but at any level in poverty and how challenging that is. And in a very similar parallel way, small businesses have different challenges, but also extremely difficult challenges. People don't realize how much harder it is to start a small business today than it was when I started the Wine Coop 40 years ago. For the last 50 years, we have been allowing more and more mergers and more acquisitions. We've had more and more red tape. And so the would-be entrepreneurs are more and more choosing not to start a business. Think about, I mean, hardware stores. Used to be a hardware store was a great small business people would have. 84% of the hardware stores in the country are owned by two companies. So an entrepreneur who might be thinking about starting a hardware store is not going to try and compete with them.
Yeah.
And we've allowed these large corporations to dominate industry after industry. For 25 years now, we've seen a decline in the number of new businesses created. And that hurts jobs, it hurts upward mobility, it increases the income inequality that we've seemed to be accepting. And that same kind of structure is, I guess, when you're talking about rural healthcare. The deck is stacked against rural communities as we become more sophisticated in our healthcare. To a certain extent, some of these wonderful miracle scans and tests and images we can do, they're not available in far too many rural communities. And that lack of fairness is something that I think we accept at our own risk. Why are we allowing our rural communities to continue to fall further behind in broadband? You know, I was beating my chest at Colorado. We'll have broadband in every city by the end of 2020. That's not happening everywhere in the country. We have to look at, not just to make sure that healthcare is freely available in rural parts of America, but they're not paying through the nose for their insurance and their coverage, which certainly in Colorado, we continue to battle that. And again, community health centers are one of the key constituents in providing affordable rural healthcare. And in many cases, it allows small businesses to offer portable benefits, right? In other words, their healthcare can go with them rather than be stuck to the old traditional norms of business-provided private insurance. In all these cases, the portability, the affordability, the quality and excellence. I mean, especially when you're a single mom, that quality matters more than anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to ask you about something that is on our minds almost all the time here at the health center. It's about healthcare, but it's about life and death. And that's the opioid crisis. So in the last several years, it has burst upon the national scene as you go around the country, communities all over, people who've lost loved ones to death by overdose, and certainly calls for a strong national response as well as local response and prevention. And I'm wondering, what do you think we ought to be doing as a country about the opioid crisis?
Well, first, we have to recognize the facts. And clearly, there were some bad actors in the pharmaceutical industry who convinced us that pain mitigation should be one of the highest, most important elements of our delivery of healthcare. They also were persuasive, clearly, to the American Medical Association that you could diminish this pain with no or very small risk of addiction.
And the provider in the field, absolutely.
The provider in the field. So, I mean, we've got to call that out. And I think there obviously need to be legal consequences. I think more than that, we need to address the reality that we are in a difficult period in this country where mental health issues have risen to the surface. And opioids are a reflection of that. When 2012, when I was part of the National Governors Association, myself and Governor Bentley of Alabama chaired an opioid task force. Huh. And so some of the basic blocking and tackling, things like making sure that your pharmacies, your drugstores, where people go to get a prescription filled, they're all connected with technology so that someone's trying to take one prescription and get more and more Vicodin or Percocets. Right. They can't do that. How do you make sure people realize that the stuff sitting there in their medicine cabinet can be stolen by their teenage kids and sold? All that stuff is real.
Yeah.
But I think this epidemic of depression that I think we're beginning to measure, and it's all across the country, I think part of it's a function of our income inequality and how our system of capitalism has walked away from being a place where anyone, if they work hard, can have a chance to pull themselves up the economic ladder. We've lost that ability. I think it's also tied in somewhat with our embrace of technology. And certainly within social media and social networks, there's a lot of suggestions that there are more haters and that those haters have a louder voice, and bullying in the classroom is much more prevalent than it was. We certainly need to begin providing more comprehensive behavioral health services in real time.
You know, I think you rightfully connect the opioid and the mental health issues together, and homelessness, which you've had a big initiative when you were in mayor's office and as well as governor. Maybe you can address both the homelessness, but also you've come out recently with a whole platform on the issue around guns, and maybe take homelessness first, and because you had a big initiative in Denver really trying to end homelessness.
Absolutely. And when I was mayor, we made chronic homelessness a primary goal. In 5.5 years, we reduced chronic homelessness by 75%. We got the whole community focused on it because it is a place where we have solutions that are cost effective.
That's right.
Right, we're spending $40,000, $45,000 a year per person for the chronically homeless. And for $20,000 a year, maybe even $15,000 to $20,000, we can provide them not only a small apartment, but also wraparound services.
That's
so
right.
We can give them counseling for their addictions. We can give them, if they've got mental health issues, we can provide them medical support, job training. I mean, for the chronically homeless, job training is hugely important on that. You know, gun safety. And this is just so sobering that we are now, if you define a mass shooting as four or more people shot in one incident, we're having just about one mass shooting a day. Mm. That should sober anyone. And, you know, we're not trying to take away people's guns. And obviously in Colorado, we were a purple state. We passed universal background checks and limit the size of magazines. But we want to go further than that. And one thing, I'd like the National Institute of Health to collect data and treat this as a public health issue.
Right. Yeah.
They've been denied by Congress the ability.
That's right.
But I mean, we're not trying to take guns away from people. But if you're a teenager and you're coming of age, you want to be able to drive an automobile, you have to study for it and you take a test and you get a license. I think 21 should be the right age for buying a weapon. And you should have to learn and demonstrate that you know how to handle a weapon properly and that you know how to store the firearms, but also the ammunition in a safe, secure place. Basic blocking and tackling that would make our society much more more secure. And still there's going to be resistance to it. Again, the lobbying efforts behind making sure that no one is ever prevented from buying a gun the moment they want to.
Sure.
I mean, again, almost one mass shooting a day. What more can you say?
Well, you're visiting a lot of people around the country. I think it must be an amazing opportunity to be a candidate and have the chance to visit many community health centers and brew pubs, hopefully lots of other kinds of organizations and communities. If you just share with us, what are you hearing from people? What do people want to see happen in this country? And what are they worried about?
It's so funny that you phrase it that way, because I was just telling somebody that I feel that it's a great gift.
Yeah.
I mean, really, that I go into a stranger's home in the center of Iowa, and there are a half dozen neighbors there. And within 20 minutes, they're telling me their deepest fears and their wildest dreams.
Yeah.
It's a level of intimacy that even running for governor, I've never seen.
Huh.
And it's in Iowa, New Hampshire, in South Carolina. These are the early primary states that the citizens really take their responsibility very seriously, that they are out here doing a job interview for each one of these 73 people running. No, it's only 24 people.
Maybe since noon, a few more.
Only 24 people running at this point. But I hear again and again, healthcare, it is probably the first thing that comes up. there are less people that care about climate change, but oftentimes they care about climate change and nothing else. And for good reason, yeah. right? We're within yeah. 10 or 12 years of, yeah. of going into unknown territory, right? Irreversible yeah. damage. But healthcare, people care about universal coverage and making sure their existing conditions are, can be taken care of. Mm-hmm. But it's not just that. It's the inflationary spiral.
Yeah.
People's copays are just going up. And
that's right.
And if I get elected president, I guarantee you I will sit down with all the key industries, right? So you have to have the doctors, the American Medical Association. You've got to have the hospitals. You've got to have the pharmaceutical industry. You've got to bring everybody in the room and say, all right, we're all going to have to give a little. But there is no reason why a doctor in a hospital can't tell you what they're going to charge for a tonsillectomy. Yeah. So we need transparency.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And again, for 30 or 40 years, the American people are subsidizing and paying a large part of the cost of medical research that creates these miracle drugs. Once it's discovered, the price supports that make that research possible
yep.
are in place in the United States so the pharmaceutical companies can get paid for their research. Whereas, you know, if you're someone who needs insulin in Canada versus in New Hampshire, the person in New Hampshire is paying 30 times more per unit of insulin for that medical drug, that miracle drug.
They have to have. Yeah.
And they've already paid their part of that research happening in the United States. So I think that has to change. It's going to take some level of government regulation. Just get back to a level playing field where the whole world is helping pay for that research. And that in the United States, we are also recognizing we pay our share, but we're not paying exorbitantly. The other big one, and Mark started talking to me about this maybe 40 years ago, but the whole thing about preventative healthcare.
Yeah.
And why don't we have a President's Council on Physical Fitness again?
Yeah.
Why aren't we really playing up the importance of activities in recess and exercise and physical fitness exercise? You know, our high schools and our middle schools are training kids at an amazing level to be able to memorize things and regurgitate them. Well, that's great.
Yeah.
Right? We're in a funny way, we're almost a filter for the really the elite higher institutions of higher education. But what we really should be doing is teaching kids stuff they really need to know, like how to work in groups, how to solve complex problems, how to innovate in terms of things that there are, and how to be healthy. In other words, how to exercise and have a fairly simple exercise regime that they can take care of themselves. My gosh, that has got to be a huge mm-hmm. part of the future of healthcare in this country. And in Colorado, we've tied that to the outdoor recreation industry. Mm-hmm. And we are huge supporters of the outdoor recreation industry.
The thinnest state in the country.
The leanest state in the country. But you know, we want to make sure that any advantages we have, and I think a lot of that's in-migration.
Sure.
People come and they yeah. love to hike, so they come
yeah.
to Colorado.
Yeah.
So we have an in-migration of thin people. We want to make sure that we provide incentives and motivations so that people are more active.
Yeah.
Everybody more active so that, you know, so that down the road we don't get swept away by this incredible inflation of healthcare costs.
Right.
We've been speaking today with former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper, Democratic candidate for the 2020 presidential nomination. You can learn more about his campaign by going to hickenlooper.com, or you can follow him on Twitter by going to @Hickenlooper. Governor, thank you for your public service, your commitment to changing America, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
What a treat, and thank you for having me, and thank you for your service. Both of you have been great champions of innovation and expanding healthcare coverage all across this country.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Social media posts wrongly claim that states legalizing marijuana also have legislated that those who use the drug cannot have guns. Actually, a long-standing federal law prohibits marijuana users from possessing or purchasing firearms, regardless of state policies. As states continue to legalize marijuana for medicinal or recreational purposes, those state policies continue to conflict with federal law. That's because marijuana remains a Schedule I drug, along with heroin, LSD, and others, and is therefore illegal in the eyes of the federal government. Posts repeatedly shared on Facebook, however, distort the facts around the issue and how it relates to gun rights. The posts claim that states that have legalized marijuana have also barred gun ownership for those who buy or are prescribed the drug. That's misleading. It's existing federal law, which dates back to 1968, that prohibits marijuana users from purchasing firearms. As the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives made clear in an open letter in 2011, federal law, quote, prohibits any person who is an unlawful user of or addicted to any controlled substance from shipping, transporting, receiving, or possessing firearms or ammunition. The letter goes on to say that anyone who, quote, uses or is addicted to marijuana, regardless of whether his or her state has passed legislation authorizing marijuana use for medical purposes, is an unlawful user of or addicted to a controlled substance. That means, the ATF said, such a person, quote, is prohibited by federal law from possessing firearms or ammunition. Karen O'Keefe with the advocacy group Marijuana Policy Project confirmed to us that she didn't know of any states legalizing marijuana and then legislating to restrict gun access for those who use it. In fact, Oklahoma, the 30th state to legalize medical marijuana last year, approved state legislation saying medical marijuana patients shouldn't be restricted from owning or possessing guns. But state lawmakers have acknowledged it is still a federal offense to possess both marijuana and a firearm. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org.
Factcheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have factcheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Of the 6.6 million births per year in this country, over half are unintended. And among teens, those rates are even higher. Colorado has been conducting an experiment for several years to examine what might happen if sexually active teens and poor women were offered the option of long-term birth control, such as IUDs or implants. The first question to answer, would they take the offer?
What was so striking was the word of mouth amongst these young women to each other and the network of support that was built to access this program through these clinics to help the tens of thousands of women over the course of the 4 to 5 years really did result in these significant decreases in unintended pregnancies and abortions.
Dr. Larry Wolk, medical director of the Colorado Department of Health and Environment.
The resultant decrease is 40% plus or minus in both categories, pregnancy and abortion, when you extend this out over an additional year, to more than 50, even approaching 60% reduction in those unintended pregnancies and abortions.
There was a significant economic benefit to the state as well.
We've seen a significant decrease in the number of young moms and kids applying for and needing public assistance. You know, we hope that then longer term, this will translate into better social and economic outcomes for these folks.
The incidence of sexually transmitted diseases dropped in this population as well.
And amongst young women 15 to 24, we've seen a decrease in sexually transmitted infections. And the rates are now below the national averages.
A free, long-term contraception program offered to at-risk teens and women trying to avoid the economic hardship of unplanned pregnancies, leading to a number of positive health and economic outcomes for all involved. Now that's a bright idea. You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.